Can you, this work? So I gave a colloquium here when this was a struggling project sometime in the 2000, 2001. So if you have a good memory, you can see, you can compare what I said then to what we delivered. So this is the menu for today. And I am going to, you know, this will look like a lot of theory to you, but what I want to do is to avoid that you think we are crazy and explain why we built a kilometer cube neutrino detector. And so that's a long introduction. Then I'll describe the experiment to you, which is called Ice Cube. And contrary to everybody's expectations, including our own, we actually found extraterrestrial neutrinos. And so I'm sure I'll get to that part. So let's start. This is called astronomy. You should know that I don't know any astronomy, neither do my colleagues. But this is a graph that, a picture that existed around the time we wrote a proposal for this experiment, and which I'm still using, although it's outdated. This tells you what's in the universe. And of course, you all know that the universe is filled with microwave photons, and there they are. But photons of all wavelengths fill the universe, including GV photons, photons I can relate to as a particle physicist. And then astronomy kind of stops, and the idea is to do astronomy above 10 GV or so with neutrinos, 10 to the minus 14 centimeter if you want to be if you are an astronomer. The question is there anything interesting there? Well, there definitely is. In fact, the universe is filled with cosmic rays. And to get used to this plot, this tells you that there are about 1,000 cosmic rays for every photon, around 100 GV. In fact, this is an amazing plot. You realize that each of these tick marks is a factor 10 in flux, in number of photons you detect. So we are basically interested in this little tail here, because this little tail, these cosmic rays have such high energy, 10 to the 8 TeV, which is my small unit in this talk, that they cannot possibly be contained in the galaxy. The magnetic field is too small. So we are looking at a flux that fills the universe. And that's an interesting observation in the context of this talk. If you watch and you take this little tail of rare cosmic rays of this enormous energy, they live in the same place as the microwave background, and occasionally these two are going to interact, and they are actually above the threshold for producing pions. So photons and protons make neutrons and pi pluses decay in neutrinos. So you can actually, it was known since the early 70s that these high energy neutrinos exist. Their energies are 1,000,000 TeV, and you can calculate on the back of an envelope the rate of these photons. You know the cosmic ray flux, you know the microwave background. This is 1950s particle physics. If you do that calculation, you find out that you'll find one event per cubic kilometer per year. So if you build a kilometer cube neutrino detector, you'll find one event per year like that. So why would you do this? Well, desperation. You know, it's 101 years ago that cosmic rays were discovered. We still don't know where and then how they are accelerated. So this one event will point back as its source, which the cosmic rays don't. That's why this problem is unsolved. And in the middle 70s, this calculation became more professional. And so here you see the data. These are kind of the cosmic rays above where my pointer is that are above threshold for producing pions on the microwave background. And they make this green band. That's the green band of neutrinos. This is the astrophysical ambiguities in this calculation, but we are already eating into this flux with the present experiment, and we'll definitely get to there in 10 years or so. What happens if we don't see anything? Then we have proven that the cosmic rays aren't protons, which is the only assumption that goes into this. Anyway, this is historically where the concept of a kilometer cube detector comes from. So we are really looking for more than this one event per year. So let me tell you a little bit about cosmic rays, which I'm not an expert in either. In fact, I'm not an expert in anything in this talk. The energetics of cosmic rays is actually what makes this problem so difficult. So I'm going to show you two theory slides, and they are both, one is dimensional analysis, the other is energy conservation. So you don't have to know very much. So where are cosmic rays accelerated? Well, somewhere where there is a magnetic field over a large distance. So if you want to accelerate a particle with a charge Q and moving at the speed of light to an energy E, its gyro radius in the magnetic field, whatever the accelerator is, has to be smaller than the accelerator. If it's not contained, you cannot accelerate it. This immediately gives you an upper limit, which tells you that you have to have large fields over large distances. And so you cannot, this dimensional analysis, you cannot avoid this. So for instance, if you apply it to a solar flare, you can actually find out that a solar flare can accelerate protons to 10 GeV. And we see those. This formula works, and we don't see higher energy. And in fact, these filaments are streams of high energy particles, and these streams, if you have relativistic particle streaming, you get a magnetic field, and so this is the accelerator. But we know that in our galaxy, we accelerate particles to at least 1,000 TeV, and so the sun won't do. But if you look at supernova remnants, you find the same filaments. This is a star that exploded about 1,000, 10,000 years ago. There are many of those. And these filaments seen in X-rays are the places where acceleration happens. And so this is bigger, and there's more energy, so maybe you can get to explain the galactic cosmic rays. Of course, it doesn't get you to 10 to the 20th electron volt, you know, 100 million TeV. But if this star had collapsed to a black hole rather than a neutron star, then the same thing would have happened. You see here, the picture is pretty much the same. You can see another picture here. What you are looking at now happens in seconds rather than thousands of years. It's not quite as nice spherical. It's beamed along the spin axis of the black hole, and it's a simulation, not an image. But all the physics is the same, and this is actually a natural way to get to the highest natural, quote unquote, a possible way to get to the highest energies. Now, you're not home yet. This is my second theory slide, which is energy conservation. Let me start with the microwave background. You know, there are 410 3-degree photons per cubic centimeter. That's for the astronomers in the audience, 10 to the minus 12 ergs, or 0.5 eV. If you now do the same calculation for the galactic cosmic rays, which is the beginning of this flux, I'll show you a real picture of the cosmic ray spectrum later. You calculate, you count the number of particles with their energy, you realize that cosmic rays constitute 10 to the minus 12 erg per cubic centimeter in our galaxy. That's actually the same number. And that's probably an accident. But it's the same energy density as in galactic, as in magnetic field. It's the same energy density as in light. So what you have to understand is that this is not some tiny component, which experimentalists always make you believe, because this flux is very small. The energy is very large. It's difficult to explain. And actually, supernova remnants, which I already mentioned, is probably the only idea, certainly the best ones. If we look at the extragalactic component, the number is smaller, but this component fills the whole universe, not the galaxy. And so it's very challenging of thinking of sources that don't have just the right magnetic field and size, but that actually can produce this amount of energy to explain the observations. And so I have already mentioned all the ideas, except there is one more, and that's this one. That is an active galaxy. It's a supermassive black hole, and there are many opportunities in this system to also accelerate particles. So there are two ideas for extragalactic cosmic rays. So I've summarized this on the next slide. So this is the galactic component, which is presumably this. This is the extragalactic component, which is one of these two. And notice this has two question marks, because I think that for practical purposes, we have ruled this out in a way that I will not talk about today. You can ask me about if you are interested. But if you think it's not, if you think this is not an interesting problem, it may not be, but it's time to solve it. This is, for instance, the paper that suggests supernova remnants as accelerators of cosmic rays, and look at the date, 1934. So, what do neutrinos have to do with this? Cosmogenic neutrinos, it's clear. Well, I make a long story short. Wherever there are cosmic rays, there are neutrinos. Where there are hadrons, there are hadronic interactions, there are neutrinos. Let me show you my two favorite examples. This is a cartoon of a supernova remnant. Here is the accelerator. So this thing is expanding. It has expanded for 1,000 years or so. Supernova explode in star-forming regions. In star-forming regions, there is high density of material. That's why it's a star-forming region. And for instance, this accelerator can interact with a molecular cloud. This is what particle physicists call a beam dump. You have cosmic rays interacting with a target of particles. It makes pions that decay in neutrinos. So how many neutrinos? Well, anyone can do this. In these interactions, you produce equal number of pi zeros, pi pluses, and pi minuses. The pi zero decays to 2 gamma rays, which the astronomers see, and we see 1 neutrino from the pion decay, and then another 2 from the muon decay. And so you just count on your fingers, and you get an answer that's correct to 20%. If you do this in very complicated ways, you get the same answer. Let me do another. Oh, by the way, this is a map of the galaxy. This is the galactic plane. So this is a map of the galaxy in 10 TeV gamma rays. It's a strange experiment that made this Milagro. But that's not the point. What I want to show, this is the strongest source in the sky. Actually, you won't see it in any other wavelength. It's a molecular cloud, and presumably it are gamma rays from this mechanism. Gamma ray bursts are a beautiful source because, you know, the star collapses to a black hole. It forms a system that's opaque, which the astronomers call a fireball. And there are electrons in there that radiate photons that you eventually see when after the fireball expands and becomes transparent. If it's a source of cosmic rays, there are protons in that fireball. And so during the expansion, the protons and the gamma rays coexist and make pions. And so this, again, is easy to compute, no theory required. The protons, you know how many, because they have to explain the cosmic rays. In fact, the gammas, the astronomer tell you again, in fact, the protons don't get out of this fireball. They're trapped and lose energy when it expands. But the neutrons get out and make cosmic rays by decay. The pions make neutrinos. So again, one proton, one neutrino for every proton. And so I have accumulated all these simple predictions in one plot. And this is the key plot in this discussion. This is the flux of cosmic rays, and be careful, it has been multiplied by E square. What that means, it's convenient because All this stuff I've talked about, presumably the acceleration is some kind of shock acceleration or reconnection, and it predicts a spectrum that falls like the energy square. So if I plot my predictions on this plot, the predictions are flat. Neutrinos are produced in the atmosphere. I will come back to this. And this is the atmospheric neutrino flux. This is our background we have to look through in the sky. And you see, we have measured this over the years with Amanda and Ice Cube itself. And remember the E square, this drops very fast. And so you don't really get any neutrinos in a reasonable time, like a year, one or two, above 100 TeV. So if you see any neutrino out there, it's a signal. One event is a signal. The sky, there's no background. And see the predictions I just made. These are the cosmogenic neutrinos. These are the gamma ray bursts. These are the supernova remnants with an error bar. So the action is when you make it to 100 TeV. That is to take home from this. These are about 10 to 100 events, neutrino events per year, of the type that I will describe in a minute. So that is the logic for building a kilometer cube detector. So we built one. The idea of how to build this goes back to 1960, and I always show this picture to have a picture of my hero, Pontecorvo, who had every idea in neutrino physics except this one. The one I'm going to describe was due to Markov. And the idea how to build a kilometer cube detector is you imagine a volume, kilometer cube volume of seawater or lake water, about 4 kilometers deep, or in a lake maybe 1 kilometer deep, and you fill this volume with photomultipliers. By the way, I'll show you a picture of a photomultiplier for the theorist. So here you have a neutrino. Notice the neutrino comes through the Earth because only neutrinos come through the Earth, so you know it's a neutrino. You don't see neutrinos, it goes through your detector anyway. But one in a million times, it may stop in your detector, interact with a proton, make charged particles, which emit Cherenkov radiation, which you can see. And if it's a muon, at the energies we are working, a muon travels kilometers. In fact, at 1,000 TeV, they travel tens of kilometers. So even if they interact outside the volume and the muon makes it to your detector, your light sensors can map the Cherenkov cone of the muon that goes at the speed of light. And if you map this cone, you know the muon direction, and the neutrino and the muon are aligned at high energy. This was Moshe Markov's idea. Now, just a remark. All the theory that goes into analyze the data is standard model physics or quantum electrodynamics. There's no ambiguity. We don't know all the physics by which this detector works. So you just fill a kilometer cube with these things you buy in Japan for about $1,000, slightly more. So they're photomultipliers this size, 20 centimeter, 10 inch. And you put enough of them and you are in business. So this is another picture of the idea. This is a muon going through Ice Cube. All these dots are photomultipliers. You see the Cherenkov cone. And after it has gone to the detector, that's what it leaves us with. So what are you looking at here? Each of these dots, Each of these dots is a single photoelectron. A bigger dot, like this one, is many photoelectrons. This may be 100. And the color gives you the time. So you follow the rainbow. This goes green to blue. So this actual muon that didn't come through the Earth, it came from the atmosphere. So this is a simulation of a muon. This is a theorist looking at a muon. This is a muon track. And you see this hair growing out. These are photons traveling through water. And you see it doesn't look anything like this. You see these bombs of light exploding. So it's much more complicated, but that's good. What you are looking at is this. These high-energy muons, they radiate photons, they make positron-electron pairs, they occasionally interact and make pions. And so that's how these bombs exploding, this catastrophic energy loss of this muon. And the higher energy, the more this happens. So you just measure the amount of light in the event, and it gives you an idea of the energy of the neutrinos, which will be very important in this talk later. So everybody started doing this, like in the early 1970s. This is the pioneering experiment here, for which there is unfortunately no picture because it failed. But they invented a lot of the techniques. And we have actually managed to build a kilometer cube detector because we had a different idea. And it should be obvious to everybody in the audience, if instead of going off the coast of Hawaii and putting photomultipliers in water, if you drill them into ice at the South Pole, it's much simpler. And that's what we did. So here is the South Pole station of the National Science Foundation. This is the runway where the planes land. This is the ice cube construction project. And so we built a detector starting in the early 90s. It was completed in 2000. This is how the South Pole looked. And so we built a detector that had about 700 photomultipliers sitting 1.5 kilometers deep. We saw neutrinos and went to ask for money to build a kilometer cube detector. Since then, we built it. And so here you see this Amanda project. And so it's basically a cube. It's hexagonal, doesn't matter. And so there are 5,160 photomultipliers through the volume. They are deployed in 86 holes with 60 photomultipliers in each hole. The only thing difficult about this project was to put these photomultipliers in the ice. And you cannot go to Houston to buy a drill from the petroleum industry. We actually built and designed it ourselves. And so this, what you are looking at here is about 40 car wash heaters that supply 4.8 megawatt of heating, of water, 200 gallons a minute under pressure. And you put this water in this hose, which is 2.5 kilometers long, and this hose goes over this drill tower. And what it does is in the next cartoon. So first, there is about 80 meters of snow, which you melt simply. So you melt it, pull it out. Then your hose reel deploys this drill, and it's just a nozzle with hot water. And the slower it falls, the bigger the hole, the faster, the narrower. So after about 2 days, this thing has gone by gravity to 2.5 kilometers. So then you have a hole this big, there's water instead of ice. You pull the drill out. This is a picture when the drill is coming out. There's nothing to show. It's a nozzle attached to a pipe. And here you see the 60 photomultipliers ready. And then you just lower a cable and attach a photomultiplier every 17 meters, 60 over a kilometer. And then you just let it sink. The water it freezes and you take data. So after a season, these are 20 cables from 20 of these strings. They're 125 meters apart. And they go into this building. And this is a two-story building that's just filled with computers. One thing interesting about the photomultiplier is at the bottom here. You don't see it in this picture. But on the neck of the photomultiplier, there is this stuff. And what it does is it digitizes the signal that comes out of the photomultiplier. To make a long story short, here you see over 120 nanoseconds a photomultiplier telling you how many photons it detects and when. And so then, whenever the photomultiplier detects it, it has a clock running, and it can put a 2 nanosecond absolute timestamp on this. it sends this digital information to the computer at the surface. So what does the computer at the surface do? There is actually no detector. It just collects information from these 5,100 plus optical modules, and it puts them into tracks, muon tracks. And here you see the detector taking data. So you see, each time you see a dot arrive, it gets some, and you see the computer happily reconstructing muon tracks. If you look very carefully, all these tracks come from above, not through the Earth. We actually would have to wait 6 minutes to see one coming through the Earth. And so, this is the bottom line. You've just looked, the whole movie was 10 milliseconds of data. So 100 times this is 1 second, 6 minutes is one neutrino, and then it's still an atmospheric neutrino, which is still background. And remember, we are looking for 10 events and maybe 100 if we are lucky. So we actually see 100 billion muons, cosmic ray muons, 100,000 cosmic ray neutrinos, and then are looking for this needle in a haystack. For the ones of you who are not experts on this, where do these muons come from, these 100 billion? Cosmic rays interact with the atmosphere at about 20 kilometers above our head. They make pions, and the muons survive, and many of them make it to the detector, as you saw, too many. The neutrinos actually also make it to the detector, but we cannot find them among the muons, so those we have to look through the Earth. So that's the idea. If you are at the South Pole, you look for neutrinos produced above Toronto, and our muons come from the Southern Hemisphere. So these are the numbers again, finding this 10 in 10 to the 11. We did find them with IceCube-2. This is a neutrino, remember, red to green to blue. So this is an upgoing muon track. I guess this is close to 100 TeV, and we should see about one of these about once a year, maybe two. Okay, so this sounds extremely difficult. Well, it's not that difficult. So what's the first thing you do? You make maps of all your neutrinos. You know, each neutrino you collect comes from somewhere above us, and you make a point on the map. This is the first map we ever made. It has 17 neutrinos, 99, and obviously they're all atmospheric. We weren't even worried. And then you see this map becoming more and more complicated with time. And this is a map taken with half the detector, and then I cannot show you anymore because it just turns black. But eventually, we come to this map by the end of the talk, and these are cosmic neutrinos. How did we do this? Well, by now, I think you understand this slide. So again, you see, we actually made it to 100 TeV. And this is the moment of truth, of course. You either go this way or you go that way. And basically, it was determined that around this energy, it would take 5 years to accumulate 5 sigma signal. That was the IceCube design. We are actually better than, we are not better. We were more lucky than that, as you will see. Don't worry what this bound means or so. But you get the idea now. If you look for neutrinos that have energies out there, and then you are in business because there's no background anymore. Now, this was a long story. If you think this didn't take very long, before Amanda, which we basically turned on around 96, 95, we saw first neutrinos. So this was upper limit on neutrino astronomy. So we knew that there was no astronomical flux of neutrinos higher than this line. So by the time IceCube was 59 strings, which is about 5 years ago, we had come to this line. This is exactly 3 orders of magnitude. So in 15 years, we worked our way to 3 orders of magnitude without seeing anything. But we were not supposed to, remember? Theorists are good. You have to believe this prediction. You have to have faith. So we were spinning our wheels, but building a better detector. Noticed, however, this was the sensitivity when Amanda at Ice Cube at 59 strings. The actual limit is there. And the reason the limit is better than the sensitivity is we actually saw a signal of 2 sigma, but we published it as a limit. After that, this kept happening and we didn't say anything. But if you notice, we stopped. Nobody noticed, but we stopped publishing limits. So, what's the outcome of this? Well, first of all, of course, you do the easy things. You remember this slide, 1 event per year. In fact, in Ice Cube, it's actually 2 events per year for the more optimistic models. And these events, you know, a million TeV, that's like an event, that event hits your detector like with a hammer. So you cannot miss it. And so we went to look for this. In fact, the way you look for this is not very difficult. You don't need neural networks and 35 cuts on your data. You just require signals in more than 300 channels, and you require more than 41,000 photons in the event. And it's even easier. These events have to come from the horizon, because these neutrinos have so high energy that if they come from below the horizon, they don't make it through the Earth. If they come from above the horizon, there is not enough target for them to make muons, because there's only air. There is no ice or Earth. So you look exactly within a degree of the horizon. And so this is an incredibly easy analysis. And so we did this, and I won't explain these cuts. And we unblinded the first data from the completed detector. And instead of seeing 100,000 TeV events, we saw 1,000 TeV events that were totally unexpected. Here I'd show you one of them. If you look, here you see the light, and the light goes up and down this string. Then remember, the next strings are 125 meters away. And then it reaches the next strings. Speed of light is slow today. Actually, the speed of light divided by the index of refraction. So here is it hits the next strings. And now you look at this, and it's a perfect ball of light. It's totally symmetric, totally uniform, isotropic, whatever the right word is. So what is this? I'll show you the second event. This was actually on the online display of the experiment. So you see the second event, and you see the computer is trying to find muon tracks in this event, and of course it cannot find any because there isn't one. Remember, the muon tracks, as it showed on one of my transparencies, the precision of the reconstruction of this should be between 0.2 and 0.4 degrees. So it really is confused. It is because there is no muon track. And you can turn this and look at it from all sides, and there's no muon track. So, of course, this is not totally unexpected, because I've by now brainwashed you that that's what we were looking for. And if your detector is too small, that's your opportunity to discover something, because you can collect these neutrinos from far away and imagine you have a bigger detector. But for all other flavors of neutrinos, nu e, nu tau, neutral current interactions, you don't make muons. So most neutrinos make showers, either because they interact with protons in the ice, or because they make an electron neutrino that showers. And so we were certainly totally prepared for this. So the picture that explains this is you have a nu e. It makes an electron, that carries 80% of the neutrino energy. This electron makes a shower that's about 3 to 5 meters long. So you get a shower of particles between here and the wall that, and these shower particles emit Cherenkov radiation, each, all of them. Now, remember, this distance in a kilometer cube detector is a point source of light. If this was a random place in Ice Cube, there would be no photomultiplier in this room. So what you see is a ball of light that just spherically expands through the detector. And if you take a muon of the same energy, this is a 300 TeV muon. It's a real event, by the way. You really can tell this from this. I hope you are convinced, right? So, first observation, just in case you have lost track, how big are these events? That's how big they are. So they just stretch from my hotel, the Holiday Inn, to the physics department. That's very important because what we are going to do in the next slide is we are not going to look at where the phototubes are hit. We are going to look when they are hit. And remember, the color you will see is the time. Red photons are early, yellow photons are late, blue photons are later, right? And that's a shower simulation. You see the red, the green, then this becomes yellow, this becomes blue. This is always late. So if the neutrino came in this direction, it means that photons you detect there are ahead in time photons you detect there, because they kind of scatter around, right? So now remember that we have these digitized waveforms from every photomultiplier. So here, this is a sample. Each of these dots is a function of time of photons deposited. And I'm going to take one of these. And this photomultiplier, this is a fit to the event. And this would be the fit to the event if you reverse it by 180 degrees. So one photomultiplier is basically very good. In fact, we would know to infinite precision the energy and the direction of these events if it were not for systematics. So everything in this detector is systematics. And in the end, we measure directions to 10, 15 degrees, unfortunately, not 0.2 to 0.4 like muons. But the energy, it's like a particle physics experiment. We typically do 10% energy resolution. So to conclude, we found these two events. These are their energies. Another important thing, one of these events came from the center of the galaxy, which is somewhere there at the South Pole. The other event came from there. This is important because above our detector, we have an air shower array. If you go and look at the air shower array at the time the neutrino came through, there is no air shower. If this were not an atmospheric neutrino, it's produced in an air shower, and the air shower should have been seen in the air shower array. In fact, the air shower produced muons that should come along with this neutrino. So anyway, we didn't claim that as a discovery. We instead went to do something more intelligent now where we had seen these events. And it's very simple. I'm not going to explain this in detail. You want to see event neutrinos that start in your detector. The advantage is that you can do total calorimetry. Remember, energy is the key. You can do complete sky coverage. Every flavor can be seen. And so you still detect the muons, which you detected before. So what you do is what every neutrino experiment does, you make a veto around your and only look event that have no light at the edges and only light inside that start in the detector. And remember, this is what I just explained. This is a muon, for instance. a neutrino that was atmospheric, and look how the air shower array lights up. But in general, if this neutrino is produced in a shower in the atmosphere, we have to see these muons as well. None of the events I will claim later have any muon in it. So what did we find? Besides the two events, we found 26 more. And of these, 21 were showers and 7 tracks. So immediately, because most of these are showers, was expected, right? Now you see all neutrinos, and it's only one of many configurations that actually makes a muon track. So the analysis is extremely simple, and this is the key figure. What I'm showing here, if you understand this, you have understood how beautiful this is. This axis, these are all the events, by the way. This axis tells you how many photons are in the event. So this is basically energy. And so 100 TeV should be somewhere here. Okay? This is how many photons there are in the veto layer, where you don't want light. So if you allow any number, then you get all your events. If you start to cut on the number of photons, less than 100 in the veto layer, you are here. So we actually required less than 3 photons in the veto layer and decided that this was our signal box. Now you know we do blind analysis. By now we understood this detector. So this whole analysis is done on Monte Carlo. And then when it's ready to go, you unblind your data and see what's there. So this was all done on simulation. And this is only one of the 2 years of data. And you see here are all the events sticking out. So it's not a needle in a haystack. It's just the needle sticks out. There's nothing to look for. Incredibly easy. So what I'm going to do now is to project this on, so you will see this again. And I'll just project the events that pass this cut. And so this is all the events as a function of light in the detector or energy. So this is the usual plot. If there are only atmospheric neutrinos, you go this way. The e to the minus 2 flux goes this way. And so this was what we found. So here are the events. 28 events. The background predicted is 5 per year, 5.3, so 10.6. And if you calculate this, of course, it's over 5 sigma. But then we have to allow for a background I won't go into, actually. A background, charged particles produce neutrinos in the atmosphere. And we don't know, we haven't observed their flux. We cannot calculate it. QCD doesn't work at 1.8 GeV. And we only have an upper limit on this flux from many years ago. And we had to allow for, we had to throw in a background for CHARM. Of course, afterwards we knew we didn't see CHARM, but in the blind analysis, so this lowered our significance to 4. But in many places, we underestimate the significance. So I won't go into that. Statistics is not the issue in this analysis. Notice, this is where, so these are the neutrinos that come through the Earth. This is straight down. This is the horizon. This is straight up. And so the whole signal comes from above. That's expected. They're mostly showers because the background mostly comes through the Earth. These high-energy neutrinos are absorbed in the Earth, so you collect them from above. And so that's exactly what we see. They are mostly showers, which are round. The 7 muons are the crosses. So the fact that most of the signal comes from above is the selection of the analysis. The fact that they're mostly showers is the selection of the analysis. It's, of course, a pity because these have poor directional resolution. Another way of looking, in the 2 years, we collected 18 events above 100 TeV when we had expected 1 to 2 per year, including the charm. Again, none of these events shows evidence of being produced in a shower. These events are actually more of the same. I want to show you one of them. Now you know this, so this shows like another boring PEV event. It's probably more many hundred TeVs, this event. But if you wait long enough, you see there's actually a muon track in it. So this is a totally innocent muon track that suddenly lost all its energy in one big splash of catastrophic energy loss. But this event is golden, of course, because now you know the direction of this track to a degree, and we can check whether we can reconstruct our shower events. And of course we can, otherwise I wouldn't be showing you this. I think I've said more. So even if you don't, you know, the 4 sigma, all that is irrelevant in the sense that the whole thing looks like signal and not like background, qualitatively, something that was not put into the analysis at all. So then you go, of course, and fit your data. This is the zenith angle dependence. This is the energy dependence to e to the minus 2 flux, and this is the answer. This is actually in the high end of this gray band. You know when I said it's 10 to 100 events? If you reduce this to nu mu, it would be 70 events. So we are on the optimistic end of the prediction. So key question, where do they come from? I don't know. Here is where they come from in declination and right ascension, normal plot. And you say, well, this doesn't look isotropic. Well, I wish you were right. I have played with maps for 15 years, and I've seen many maps like that. And by the time you come to 40, 50 events, you say, well, maybe not. Now, you want to look at this cluster here. In this cluster, if it were an isotropic map, there would be 0.7 events, and there are 7. But this is a posteriori statistics, and this is how you do pathological science. So if you want to know what these events look like, someone reminded me, look at the 50 papers on the web that all know where these events come from. And the only thing you can conclude is that we don't know. So, of course, now you are dying to see this in galactic coordinates. By the way, if you take all trials into account, this is only 8% probability. So, we'll see. So, this is the plot in galactic coordinates. And you see the overlay here. The overlay is our resolution, 15 degrees. So it's possible that this is the galaxy and this is extragalactic. That's how high-energy photon maps look like. But I wouldn't give 5 cents for this to be true at this point. In fact, IceCube can see high-energy PV photons from the southern hemisphere. And our highest fluctuation in the map aligns with this event, which is one of the 1,000 TeV events. The other 1,000 TeV events, as I already said, comes from the center of the galaxy. So you can, you know, make up lots of stories on the basis like this. The truth is there's not enough information. Now, these are 1,000 TeV neutrinos. If they are made by cosmic accelerators, the accelerators have about 100 times higher energy. So that's 10 to the 17 in cosmic ray language. That's a very annoying number. Because if you look at the spectrum at 10 to the 17, so PV is, so this is 100 times 1,000 PV. And so there, it's exactly the region where we are not sure whether the cosmic rays are galactic or extragalactic. I would bet my wallet, which has not much money in it, that they are galactic there, but there could be a subdominant extragalactic component. Notice, however, that is all kind of structure in the spectrum there that the ice cube air shower array is mapping. So this is something very interesting is happening there. So let me conclude, I'm 1 minute over time. We have found the first evidence for cosmic neutrinos. This evidence is already discovery, as you will see in my next slide. And the origin is not revealed yet. The key, we have 1 more year of data that's now being analyzed. And the key is to go back and collect 50, you know, if this is a if this flux exists in the northern hemisphere, we should see about 50 to 100 muons. With that, you can make a real sky map, and we'll know the answer. And we have these events. They are being analyzed. The directions have not been unblinded, so don't try to get anything out of me. I don't know. But we unblinded 10% of the next year of data, and we found this event, which is, if you by now, you know, I've carefully left the photons out, the photomultipliers out, but these events, if you saw it on the detector, it's higher energy than the two we had. So this event alone would put the previous analysis over 5 sigma. There are many more. The key is to find muons, which I won't tell you about, but I want to stop here, and so obviously stay tuned and we'll know. Thank you.